Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it is time for a classic episode of Tech Stuff. This one originally published on October 30th, 2013. And that would be Halloween-een, or Halloween Eve, which is already an eve. It's titled, There's a Halloween Event on the Horizon. I remember this. It's where I got to talk about the movie Event Horizon and the wonderfully terrible technologies in that film. I hope you guys enjoy it.
We thought we'd take a horror movie and look at the science and technology in that horror movie, as well as just kind of discuss what that horror movie is all about, sort of the same way we did Independence Day back for the 4th of July. Now, there aren't that many horror movies that we could think of that have a heavy tech angle. There are some.
There are plenty. And we also, I mean, you know, we wanted to do something that isn't as completely offensive as it could be. I mean, you know, it's the movie that we chose is rated R.
Yes.
And I think both of us enjoy it.
From a kind of tongue-in-cheek way. Sometimes, yeah, I genuinely enjoy this film, but it is not what I would call a good movie. It is Event Horizon.
Yes.
It is a space movie. It's a movie set in space. It's all about space. Let's go ahead and give you an overview of what the basic plot is in case you haven't seen it.
Right. Although I will say that this discussion is going to involve lots of spoilers. And like I said, we do enjoy this movie. I want you to see it and to not be spoiled when you go into it. So if you have not ever seen the film and you are of an appropriate age and constitution to watch a thing with kind of gory violence and
yes,
and mild nudity, occasional cursing, then maybe just turn this podcast off and wait until you can watch the movie.
Right. Now, I will say, since the film came out in 1997, all bets are off.
You're
so
slacking.
Here we go. Basic plot. All right. You've got a ship. It's called the Event Horizon, and it's supposedly a research ship that's meant to explore the further reaches of our solar system. And on its maiden voyage, it disappeared somewhere just beyond Neptune. Now, that happens in the year 2040,
7 years later, a research or a rescue ship, rather,
is sent out.
Sent out with a particular engineer, a scientist who had worked on the Event Horizon's propulsion system.
He actually designed the entire ship.
Yeah. So he's going along with them. They don't know what their mission is when they first leave, but they are to go out to Neptune and try and find the origin of a mysterious transmission that apparently came from
the Event Horizon. From the Event Horizon, right. And rescue the ship and the crew if at all possible.
Right. So they go out there and bad stuff happens, y'all. First of all, it turns out that the Event Horizon's secret propulsion system is something that is called a gravity drive in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that it messes with space, right?
It creates a black hole, essentially.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that a little bit more later on.
Yeah,
we'll
discuss the entire black hole thing at length because it's interesting. It's what's really interesting is how much of the science the movie at least attempted to get right.
Yeah, yeah. I want to give it a lot of kudos. I do think that it really tried. Like, gold star, you tried.
It didn't just use black hole as some sort of
magic
placeholder, no. Right? They tried to find a way of explaining this. And there is some scientific basis for some of the stuff they talk about anyway.
But because it's a horror movie, when it tried to create this hole in space-time to travel through, instead, it accidentally ended up in a hell dimension.
Yeah.
The idea and brought a bunch of hell back with it.
Right.
And so the ship is haunted.
The ship is haunted by hell.
And or is hell itself.
Yeah, it could
it's actually kind of unclear.
Possessed.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. Yeah, so the idea being that when the gravity drive is activated, the ship travels through a dimension, in this case, a hellish dimension of pure chaos and evil, as one character says.
Direct quote, yeah.
and it brings something back. And the crew is deader than dead.
Super dead.
Yeah, they are so dead. you see lots of really, really dead people. And then the rescue mission comes aboard and tries to do what they're supposed to do, and then hilarity ensues. We won't spoil everything, but essentially, obviously you have to dismantle the rescue ship or else they could just leave. So that gets taken care of. Then you have to separate out the crew members for various reasons and then have terrible things happen to them. And all this happens at great gore and detail. And it's entertaining. It's not, it's not Shakespeare, but it's fun.
I really appreciate that the film, and this was directed by Paul Anderson, A. Paul Anderson. He has some initials in there somewhere that I'm completely missing, and I did not write them down. But he's the same guy who directed the Mortal Kombat movie.
Yes. He said that he wanted to have a turn at directing something a little more...
Highbrow?
No, he was talking about gory.
And,
he wanted a chance to make an R-rated picture
Mortal Kombat. Because Mortal Kombat was PG-13.
Yeah.
I want to give the film a lot of kudos. So it starts out with this brief timeline. And I'd say that for 1997, it was a hopeful but not completely ridiculous timeline. They were saying that the first permanent moon colony in this science fiction setting was in 2015, and that commercial mining on Mars began in 2032.
2032, considering that, we've got some outfits here on Earth that are trying to get to Mars around that same time period. All right, yeah, and the lunar colony in 2015 is way too ambitious, but back in 1997, there was no way of knowing that
the space program
was going to have so many financial hits.
Right. So...
Yeah, getting into it, one thing that confused me was the idea of even having a ship. Now, the Event Horizon's outer solar system exploration
was
mission,
a cover.
That's a cover story.
Yeah.
It still seems
NSA code black, the real reason. That's
yes.
the actual thing that they said in the film, and I'm still not sure what that means,
yeah.
But it sounds really nifty.
Right. I guess it just means super duper secret, y'all. you have to know the secret handshake in order to get access to it. But the thing that made me confused was just the idea of even building a ship for that sort of thing. We've built
probes.
Well,
so that people can get out onto the surface of Neptune and walk around and poke things.
On gas giants. Yeah,
right.
That sounds like a great idea.
Really hot gas giants where the winds are 2,100 kilometers per hour.
Right.
That's
Neptune,
exactly where
Neptune has the most high force winds in the entire solar system. Not a very nice place to go visit. So it's lots of methane in the atmosphere too. Not great. Hydrogen and helium also in the atmosphere. It's not a very great planet to go visit if you don't have some massive protection around you. It just seemed weird because we could do robotic probes, that kind of stuff, or that sort of thing, but whatever. So they'll also, just to get out of the way, this is one of those space movies where we do hear sounds in space.
Uh-huh. And the initial sequence turns out to be a dream sequence, so you can't entirely blame the fact that you're hearing a thunderstorm on Neptune from space on the fact that it's...
Yeah, it's some sort of hallucination.
It's a hallucination or dream or something.
But,
so.
But assuming the rest of the movie is not a hallucination or dream, which I, as far as I can tell, that's not the intent.
That's not the point. No.
There's plenty of examples of hearing sound in space.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily that the characters hear it, but the audience hears it.
Also, a good point from this general area of the film, they're showing spaceships as being three-dimensional and space as being three-dimensional and things coming at each other from different angles, which I absolutely approve of.
Right. It's not all in the same plane.
Right.
Like it would be in most Star Trek.
Yeah.
Not all Star Trek, but most Star Trek.
Up until some certain point, Star Trek really only discovered that space is multidimensional, I think, in like
late
1990s.
Late in the game. Yeah. And so there's also some other interesting things. They do have artificial gravity in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how they generate it, although they appear to have some other means of controlling gravity with the gravity drive. They talk about using electromagnets to control the flow of gravitons.
Mm-hmm.
Gravitons right now are a hypothetical particle. We think they exist based upon the math, but we have not identified or observed gravitons.
But I'm cool with this science fiction film positing that we're going to discover the graviton particle within the next 40 years.
Okay.
That's cool.
Well, 30 years. Yeah.
30 years.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
ooh, right. That's right. Sorry, I'm old. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where maybe if they discovered gravitons, they also figured out how to create artificial gravity. Cause what they are not doing is creating it through rotating a spaceship or space station.
Right.
In order to use the centripetal force to kind of fake gravity.
Right.
Right. So, we'll give them that too. I don't understand ever shaving with a straight razor.
Don't have to shave my face, so
I just don't think that's a wise idea to do in space. But then, I mean, if you got artificial gravity, you're pretty.
This is Sam Neill's character, Sam Neill playing the physicist who, as it turns out, designed this Event Horizon ship.
Yeah.
And he's got some problems that the film goes into pretty extensively. And so the straight razor, as it turns out, is symbolic.
Right. You find out that his wife committed suicide
with a straight razor.
With a straight razor,
which makes me even more concerned for him that he is using that to shave with.
Yeah,
y'all, this is a bad. This is going bad places.
A psychologist would probably have a few things to say about it. I thought that the space station that Sam Neill's character is on at the beginning of the film was a little odd in that think of a massive grid made out of like scaffolding, or mm-hmm. if you've ever worked on a theater set where you've got the grid that you hang the lights off of, that looks like the skeleton of this space station. It just looks like a massive grid of this stuff.
It looks like the set to Stomp or something, yeah.
And occasionally you have these habitats that are, you can tell that there are these things that are connected to the grid structure that are where everyone lives, but they don't seem to be connected to each other. Like they're on different parts of the grid, and this thing is enormous.
They don't seem to be connected, yeah.
Yeah.
You wouldn't really want to spacewalk in between them because
right.
spacewalking is pretty dangerous in low Earth orbit, which
yeah, exactly.
the station is said to
I
be
assume,
in. So.
Title
comes up that says low Earth orbit.
I didn't pay attention at that point, and I took notes, and I could not remember if the space station was in orbit around Earth or Mars, because there were comments that made me think, well, maybe they were in orbit of Mars. That makes some of the rest of this discussion much easier for me. But
okay.
I did think it was neat that it looked modular, which meant, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Right.
You would want to be able to build onto any sort of permanent space station in a way that would allow you to not have to reinvent the wheel every time. So if it's modular, you just add a new module on. That makes sense. So, all right, I'm giving it that too. The rescue ship is called the Lewis and Clark,
mm-hmm.
Named after the explorers who, quote unquote, discovered lots of stuff in America. If you can consider people who had been living there for hundreds and hundreds of years to be not important enough to say they discovered it. But hey, fun times. I thought the design of this was a little weird, particularly the bridge. I wrote down that their seating structure on the bridge was weird.
That main captain's chair drives me crazy. So this is a bridge in which all of the, crew member chairs are normal kind of chairs. They can roll around a little bit, but they're basically affixed
to
the ground.
Kind of like office chairs.
Office chairs-ish. And this captain's chair is suspended from this kind of track in the mm-hmm. ceiling, like a roller coaster seat.
Yeah.
And it looks really goofy.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what they were going for.
Lawrence Fishburne, who plays the captain, sits in this chair. It means that his feet are actually dangling off the ground. He doesn't have contact with the ground. It allows him to turn 360 degrees and move along this track. But so would a chair with wheels on it.
And or standing up.
Yeah. So I don't understand this, because if you were to argue, well, this way, if there were some sort of problem, his chair wouldn't go sliding all over the room. But then everyone else's chairs seem to have that ability. There's one guy who pushes back from his workstation and rolls halfway across the bridge. So if you're not going to do it for everybody, don't do it for anyone. That's what I say. Let's make this fair. Gosh darn it. But yeah, I just thought that was a weird thing.
Yeah. Now, I did want to say that I do actually like the design aesthetic of the Lewis and Clark, because it's more functional than pretty most of the time.
Yes.
And I feel like it's very much based in the general aesthetic of today's NASA ships.
Right. It looks like it's functional. It doesn't look like it's made out of, you know, it's not some sort of Star Wars type thing where everything's pristine and beautiful as long as you're working for the Empire. it's definitely, it's more in the Firefly range where this looks like this is something that does work. It doesn't look like it's a set necessarily.
Right. You know, it's a little bit roomier than perhaps a real spaceship would be in order to have those good
camera
shots.
Angles,
But other than that, I'm willing to give them that.
It reminded me a little bit of like an expanded submarine, which is kind of what you would expect
to see.
What
you're going for, sure.
The propulsion system I thought was really interesting. This is kind of just mentioned offhand in dialogue that it's an ion drive, which is a real thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So an ion drive uses thrusters and ionized particles. Those are charged particles in order to accelerate, and they can generate these charged particles and excite them in two major ways right now. We have the electrostatic force, which involves usually bombarding particles with electron beams so that you build up a negative charge. And there's also the electromagnetic approach, where you use electromagnets to excite these ions. At any rate, either way you're using this, you can output these ions and create thrust. But the thing about this is that it builds acceleration. The accelerating force is very low.
So it reaches very fast acceleration at the end of this process, but it takes a minute to get there.
It takes a long time. Yeah, you're talking about, like, it's continuously accelerating, so it's not like it accelerates and then just stops, but the rate of acceleration is very low. So I'm a little concerned that they wouldn't be able to get from Earth to Neptune in any reasonable amount of time using an ion drive. I mean, I guess you could do it, but I think it would take longer than 56 days, which is how long it takes within the film.
I actually did do the math, and the current ion thrusters that we've got can reach speeds of some 90,000 kilometers per second, which is over 200,000 miles per hour in space, which is pretty screaming compared with, like, the space shuttle, which is about 18,000 kilometers per second. But even if the vehicle could go at that speed the entire distance from Earth to Neptune, which it could not, see above Re, it takes a long time to warm up.
Right.
It would still take 553 days, unless I did the math wrong, which I don't think I did.
That sounds about right, because the distance between Earth and Neptune is about 4.4 billion kilometers.
Right. And granted, we're talking about 40 years in the future, and 40 years can bring a lot of technological changes.
So sure, sure.
I think it's a possibility, but it's a stretch.
Yeah, cutting it down. I mean, you're just talking about such huge distances. And keep in mind, 4.4 billion kilometers, that's the average distance between Neptune and Earth.
As we know,
orbits change.
Yeah,
so
I calculated that from the closest point at which it's about 4.3 billion miles apart.
Right. Yeah, and even then you have to plan it, like, just as we had to plan the Curiosity rover to land on Mars months in advance, because, you know, the orbits as the planets continue to move across their orbital paths even after you launch the ship, because they do not just hold in place. Yeah. So you can't just launch when they're closest, because they'll be moving apart from each other from that moment moving on. So it's complicated, y'all.
Yes. But at any rate, in order to not be bored for some 50 days on this ship, the crew
or die,
I guess, the crew goes into stasis. Right. They do give the excuse of at the speeds that we're going, your skull would liquefy.
Which is not true.
That is super inaccurate.
Okay. Yeah. They're talking about they would endure forces of excess of 30 Gs or around 30 Gs. That's 30 times the gravitational force you feel here on Earth. All right, here's some other issues. First of all, going into stasis, that's always a problem, right? as far as we understand it today?
Because anything that is going to slow down your bodily functions is not really that good for you. And most of the time, movies portray it as freezing, or in this case, it's being in this giant tub of
goo.
Of stirf.
Yeah, it's more liquid than goo, I would say. Yeah, it comes out like water, but it's...
But that's just not good for your body.
No. Your skin will absorb liquid, especially once the oils begin to wash off. That's why if you spend too long in the bath or in the pool, your fingers start to prune up. Your epidermis is absorbing water, and wherever the epidermis and dermis meet, it's anchored. That's where you have those valley parts, the crevices that are in the pruny skin. And then the bulgy bits, that's where all the liquid has been absorbed. So imagine that all over your body. It's not great. It gives rise to potential for bacterial infections. It's bad stuff. Also, your muscles would atrophy after you had been spending that much time. We're talking about, 2 months motionless, you would be in bad shape by the end of that. They don't appear to be at all affected in that way. They cough a bit and that's it.
Yeah. Sam Neill's character, who is not used to it, kind of stumbles a little bit and like isn't sure if he wants coffee. And that's about the
worst problem he has. But the other side of it, the whole 30G issue. So first of all, the record for enduring gravitational forces goes to John Stapp, who for a very, very short moment experienced a force of 46.2 Gs. He was doing acceleration tests. This was part of the whole, like, how much can a person endure? Turns out, anything above, say, 20 Gs or so, you're talking eyeballs out. Gravitational forces. That's what they refer to it as, by the way, guys. So at 46.2, his eyeballs stayed in his head. They didn't pop out.
Well, that's a relief.
But he did suffer permanent eye damage. He had vision problems for the rest of his life. He did live a good long while after that. It wasn't like he suffered serious health issues that led to his death, but he did have serious health issues. They just were chronic and lasted for the rest of his life. So, but at 46.2 Gs, even at that incredible amount of force applied to you, your skull will not liquefy. Your brains and eyeballs might if you're exposed to it for a long enough period of time.
So a certain 52 days, like a couple months, you might.
Yeah, you might have some issues at that point. So, yes, it would be deadly. However, I'm pretty sure that submerging someone in liquid would not mean that you had a get-out-of-jail-free card for enduring that amount of force.
Yeah, especially not water. I don't think that's how physics works.
No, if you were suddenly put under the ocean at a depth where the pressure would be enough to crush you, you still get crushed, even if the whole thing in the abyss where they have to breathe in the liquid oxygen is meant to say that if you have
that you're being pressurized.
Yeah. If you have air inside your lungs, then that's going to pop your lungs. But by putting liquid, you can endure more pressure. You still are not able to endure endless amounts of pressure. So I'm not sure that would necessarily help. But then that brings us to the kind of computer devices they use, which are tablets.
Yeah. And I think that for 1997, it's a pretty good estimation of what they were going to have in 40
future,
years.
Sure.
No one working on this movie clearly had talked to Steve Jobs and knew that the iPad was going to come out. So.
Yeah. Well, in 97, that might have been a little premature. I mean, they use tablet computers. I think by 2040, we'll probably have moved beyond your basic tablet. But again, that's extrapolating from now as opposed to from 1997.
And that's another thing that I'm willing to give them a pass on due to the fact that all of the tech on their ship, which I think is purposefully clunky, and I think it's for purely aesthetic reasons, but I can excuse it by the fact that all of the tech on their ship needs to withstand the same forces, these incredible skull liquefying forces, and so that therefore, if it's a little bit clunky, maybe that's why.
Just butting in here to say we'll be right back to talk more about Event Horizon in just a moment, but first let's take a quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Hello! Acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now, it's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to Event Horizon, and let's finally talk about this gravity drive thing.
Yes.
It's bizarre.
Well, okay, so we hear the scientific explanation of it before we ever see the thing.
Yes, we do. He says that the gravity drive will create an infinite curvature of space, resulting in a singularity. And here's the thing, guys. That's a real thing. Singularity, infinite, well, real in the sense of this is how we understand black holes right now, according to general relativity.
Right. Yeah, this is absolutely a concept that is based in reality. And I was super proud of the way that they described it. The scientist character goes into this kind of long spiel, and all of the other guys go like in English, please.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of wish that they had let him go for another half hour, because right. I could have listened to that.
It's hilarious because first he says, oh, well, in layman's terms, and it's really pretty simple. I mean, it's the simplest description of a black hole you can get to without super dumbing it down, which he ultimately does do.
Yeah, yeah. he describes a retaining magnetic field focusing a narrow beam of gravitons to fold space-time.
Yeah. And then this creates a wormhole through which a ship can travel. And the idea being that you can fold space-time so that the two points that you are interested in, your beginning and your destination, are adjacent to one another, even if in reality they are across the universe from each other. So let's use an example. Let's say that you get an old-style roadmap. I'm talking about a paper roadmap. Okay. Uh-huh. You got a paper roadmap and you want to travel between New York City and Los Angeles, California. And normally you would have to trace a pathway that would go along highways and you would travel thousands of miles. But what if you could just fold the roadmap so that New York City and Los Angeles were touching one another on the two sides?
Mm-hmm.
And then you were able to magically jump between New York City and Los Angeles, then unfold the map so it's back to its regular space. Suddenly it looks like you've traveled faster than light. You have crossed thousands of miles in an instant, apparently violating Einstein's theory of relativity.
Except for the part where Einstein and Rosen in the 1930s, I believe, came up with a concept of wormholes that allows for this, which says that if you have a mass on that little New York blip and a mass on the LA blip, mm-hmm. That are both massive enough to push space-time towards itself in the way that space-time is
folded,
hypothetically
yeah.
a folded moving sheet
right.
of space-time.
Because matter curves space-time, and space-time determines how matter moves.
Then eventually you're going to get these two points touching, and that
right.
if they were touching enough that they could break through.
Yeah, essentially you're talking at that
some
point.
Some matter could break through.
You're removing distance, right? You're no longer traveling, because you're not traveling faster than light at that moment. At that moment, those two distances are touching. Or those two points are touching. So there isn't a distance between them. If there were a distance between them and you move faster than light, that's when Einstein says, hey, stop breaking the law. All right. So let's talk about how is this related to actual real world physics? So from what we understand with black holes, here's the deal. You got a star that's at least 8 solar masses or larger. And as that star dies, it loses energy. It begins to collapse in on itself. And so it starts to collapse in. Gravitational forces get stronger. You get this tiny point that gathers all the mass. We usually refer to it in math as being a point that has zero volume. But because there is mass within that zero volume, it has infinite density. So you've got this point of infinite density. That's creating this incredible gravitational pull in a large region around it. Now, we define the region around it where, let's say there's an imaginary boundary that you can see around a black hole.
Which there would not be. But
yeah, but let's imagine that you can see this boundary. And you know that boundary represents the section of space where if you were to pass beyond that boundary, you would no longer be able to escape the gravitational pull of that black hole.
This is the point of no return.
Yeah, this is the point where even light itself cannot escape the black hole. It just will go right toward the singularity, depending upon how the singularity is formed. We'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, so that point, that
region,
area, that yeah. region is called the event horizon.
Yeah.
And I would like to state for the record right now, the terrible idea it is to name your ship after the point of no return.
Yeah, it's like calling your boat the iceberg magnet. You know, you don't want to call your boat iceberg magnet.
Or perhaps akin to naming your undersea paradise after something out of the Book of Revelation. It's just a terrible
or even Atlantis
plan.
Yeah, you don't want to necessarily go with that connotation if you think about it for too long. But yes, so the event horizon is named after this region of space where if you pass through it, you are pretty much guaranteed to go into the singularity. When I say pretty much guaranteed, there are some caveats. All right, so because there are different types of black holes. We quantify and we classify black holes based on three basic features. These are pretty much the only features black holes have according to our theory of relativity because they're weird things. They have mass, they may or may not have spin, and they may or may not have a charge. So the basic black hole that is probably the simplest version, although not the most commonly found in the universe, is the Schwarzschild black hole, which has no spin. It does have an event horizon. And essentially this black hole, you can just think of it as a single point in space of that infinite density that is pulling you toward it if you get beyond that event horizon. So it's just everything goes toward the center of that point. You don't have any rotation there. You know, you can try to use thrust to keep you from accelerating into the point, but it's just after a point, there's no point in doing that anymore either. You're done. Spaghettification mm-hmm. is on the way.
Yeah.
Which is where that's the idea that as you get closer to the black hole's gravity, things elongate and become noodle-like, thus the spaghettification. It is probably not terribly pleasant, although I'm guessing you would not be alive at that point anyway.
I'm thinking not.
Yeah.
But I think more frequently, theoretical physicists say that this probably happens more frequently, and also certainly more frequently in films, is predicted the Kerr black hole.
Yes, the Kerr, K-E-R-R. So the Kerr black hole is formed from solar masses, and because stars usually are rotating, there's a rotational force that has to conserve the angular momentum. This is another law that you have to follow. It has to conserve that angular momentum. So the black hole itself is spinning.
Right, which is where you get those pretty graphics with that kind of rotational cloud of stuff falling into a black hole.
You can say the black hole at the center of the Milky Way is rotating. Therefore, it's dragging space as it rotates, which causes this rotational force that ends up affecting the entire galaxy. It's pretty remarkable stuff, right? Well, the other interesting thing about this is that spinning means the singularity at the center of a Kerr hole is not a single point like it is in Schwarzschild. Instead, it's an infinitely thin ring that is also spinning. And they are a little more complicated. They don't have just the event horizon. They also have something called the ergosphere. This is the region of space that is distorted because of the rotational force of this black hole. So this is an overly simple model that I'm going to give you. It does not directly relate to how we see this happening in the universe. But imagine putting your hand in a container of tranquil water and then moving your hand around and seeing how it disturbs the water. The ergosphere is kind of like that. It's this region where that rotational force is dragging the space-time and distorting it as a result, which is kind of funky. There's also another little region that's the static limit. That's the boundary between the ergosphere and normal space-time that is not being directly dragged and distorted by this black hole. Well, the interesting thing about this theory is that some people have proposed the hypothesis that if you were to encounter one of these black holes and you were able to enter the event horizon in a particular way where you could slingshot around that thin rotating singularity, you might not fall into the singularity. You might get shot out again, but you get shot out at a different point in space-time. Thus, you would have this wormhole theory. I don't know that you could necessarily control exactly where you would end up or when you would end up, because space-time, there's also the possibility this could allow for time travel, though that increases the grandfather paradox, and there's other issues that we'd have to get into. That's an entirely different podcast.
I don't recommend trying that without a bow tie and a fez.
I tried doing it, but then I went back in time and stopped myself. So I just can't, guys. I mean, I'll just do it again. And the Wayback Machine is still in Mongolia, so we're kind of stuck.
But so this is a hypothetical possibility.
Yes.
I mean, and all of this, we should say, is based upon theoretical astrophysics, which, if you couldn't tell from the name, we've never gone out in a ship and checked out a black hole and been like, oh, that's how it works.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this is all based on the way that we observe electromagnetic radiation behaving in spaces around what we have called black holes.
Yeah. And it's also based on a lot of math that we've tried to make work out. But things like infinite density and zero volume, it's really hard to deal with that. It's impossible for us to truly conceive of it. It's beyond our ability to do so. And in fact, some people have gone so far, in fact, I don't think it's that far really, but to say that singularity is really more of a placeholder. Like, the terms we're using are placeholders that are good enough for now, but we need better clarification, and some integration of the quantum model of physics might end up clarifying these terms so that we don't just have these vague placeholders.
Right. There is, speaking of quantum stuff, scientists are theorizing that this is happening at the quantum level, like at the Planck kind of level of particles. Wormholes are being created a lot.
Yeah.
And
well, that was one of the things that they talked about with the Large Hadron Collider,
right,
was that these collisions could result in tiny little black holes that are on the, you know, atomic or smaller scale and last less than a nanosecond long. That's how long they last. But it may, of course, that knowing that they were going to make some black holes, that made some media outlets go, oh, we're all gonna get sucked into a black hole and die. And thus we had things like, you know, has the world been destroyed by the Large Hadron Collider? And you go to the URL and it would say no. one interesting thing, there's a paper published in the Physical Review Letters recently by Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Pullen. And it was about a quantum black hole model in which the black hole doesn't have a singularity, but rather is a gateway. So this gateway would put you into possibly another universe, not necessarily another dimension, but another universe. There's some issues with this that we'd have to explore. It may very well be true, and it may be that this is the beginning of replacing those placeholders like singularity with more specific terms. But some of the problems involve things like, well, you probably still wouldn't survive any kind of trip through a black hole. The tidal forces you would undergo as you would go through this intense gravity would still squish you and kill you. If you did somehow find a way to survive, there's no guarantee that what universe you would end up in would have the same laws of physics that our universe has, and thus you end up dying anyway because physics don't work. And then there's the problem of, well, if there are black holes in various universes that are connecting each other together, where are the outputs? Because we don't see any in our universe. Where are the white holes? These holes where matter from the black hole on the other end is being spewed out into the universe. Because if the black hole end is pulling everything in, the white hole end must be pushing everything back out. And if we don't see evidence of that in our universe, either that means that we only have exits, no entrances, or there's some other problems with this theory, or it may just be that we haven't found a way to observe it yet. I don't know. Maybe it turns out that white holes are the source of all dark matter, which represents more mass than anything else we can observe. We don't know what dark matter is. Maybe that's it. If it turns out to be that, you can mail my Nobel Prize. Our address is on the website. So at any rate, we're going to assume that in the movie, they want to open up a Kerr black hole, K-E-R-R, not C-A-R-E. And they're going to use that to zip over to some other part of the universe, and that things went wrong. So I think you think it's safe to say that that's more or less what they meant based upon what's said in the film.
I feel like that's extrapolating, but a fair yes. extrapolation. I mean, you know, I think that he was talking about a pretty straight wormhole kind of situation.
Yeah,
but
I'm just trying to justify it any way I can.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that the science in Event Horizon back in 1997 was ahead of its time, and that the quantum research that we're talking about right now ends up being exactly what, or more or less what they were saying in that movie, which would be kind of cool. Cause then you're like, well, the science was wrong, but then it was right again.
Huh.
Based upon our understanding. Well, we've got a lot more to say now that we've got the black hole stuff out of the way. But before we do, let's take another quick break to thank our sponsor. Now, you've probably tried Hulu.com. Now, with Hulu Plus, you can watch your favorite shows anytime, anywhere. Hulu Plus lets you watch thousands of hit TV shows and a selection of acclaimed movies on your television or on the go with your smartphone or tablet, and it all streams in HD for the best viewing experience. With Hulu Plus, you can watch your favorite current TV shows like Saturday Night Live, Community, and Family Guy, and you can also check out exclusive content, including Hulu originals like The Awesome, starring SNL's Seth Meyers, and Moon Boy, starring Chris O'Dowd from Bridesmaids. Hulu Plus also offers a great selection of acclaimed films. For only $7.99 a month, you can stream as many TV shows and movies as you want, wherever you want. Right now, you can try Hulu Plus free for 2 weeks when you go to HuluPlus.com/tech. That's a special offer for our listeners, so make sure you use HuluPlus.com/tech so you get the extended free trial and they know we sent you. Go to HuluPlus.com/tech now. You know, one of the things I love about Hulu Plus is getting access to old shows that I remember loving when they were on, but hadn't really revisited in a long time. One of those, of course, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Joss Whedon really made his name with this series, and it changed television. There's so many shows now that obviously follow in that same kind of model. So if you never actually seen that series, I highly recommend it. Go check that out. All right, so let's get back to the movie. Now, we've talked about the gravity drive. We talked about the ion propulsion. We talked about whether or not your skull would liquefy. Surely we've gotten through all the problems, right?
Oh, we're actually still pretty early in the movie. This only takes us up through before they're even on the titular Event Horizon. So
yeah.
We've got a lot of ground. We've got a lot of space to cover.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So there's a good side and a bad side to this, Lauren. The good side is that pretty soon we're going to be talking about supernatural stuff, which has nothing to do with technology, and then we're okay.
Oh, right, right. Because when you start talking about hell dimensions invading, I'm like, well, I'll give that a pass because I don't have
fiction.
Any data how that would work.
It doesn't involve technology or any science that we understand at this moment, so therefore we cannot comment on it. However, are some science stuff we can talk about.
Yeah, okay. So when our search and rescue crew of the Lewis and Clark arrives at the Event Horizon, it is... I guess it's supposed to be in orbit of Neptune.
That was what I felt. It was supposed to be, it's in a decaying orbit around Neptune,
but it's kind of within Neptune's atmosphere because there are all of these big storms going on. And,
yeah.
And it is accurate that there would be big storms on Neptune. It is much, much like Jupiter. It has these very giant, very violent, slightly quicker storms. The storms on Jupiter are much longer lasting.
Right. But here's the problem is that if that ship were in fact in within the atmosphere, that atmosphere would slow the ship's pathway down so much that the orbit would have decayed much more rapidly. The ship would be crashing into Neptune.
Oh, right.
So the clouds there are a problem because it would suggest that it's too late. If it's truly in orbit, it would be above the atmosphere. But since it's in the atmosphere, I think that we have to say this is for the spooky effect. Because how can you have a haunted house movie in space without a thunderstorm going on outside? Right?
I'd say pretty easily. I've seen Alien and that basically worked, which isn't a haunted house situation.
But still close. It's close. I mean, we're playing upon the same primal fears, obviously. I'm just amazed there weren't space wolves howling outside the windows of the ship. But,
actually there were enough characters having hallucinations that I am actually shocked that they did not have space wolves.
Yeah. Well, maybe we missed it because some of those were like montages of really fast clips of, you know, this just looks like a Clive Barker nightmare scenario smashed into half a second. So maybe there were some space wolves in there. We don't know, but there definitely was a storm.
Yes. If anyone, by the way, wants to Photoshop some space wolves into some footage from Event Horizon,
I'm looking at you, Aaron Cooper.
I'm absolutely willing to read your name on air.
Yeah.
For that.
So, all right. What about the way that they, before they get on the Event Horizon, they decide to take a look and see if there's anything alive on it. They do a life scan.
Right. Well, there's a bunch of life scanning related technology that happens in this middle portion of the film. And yes, one is from the Lewis and Clark.
Yep.
And then once they get onto the ship, they've got these little shiny laser related hand devices.
Yeah, mostly looks like a laser that's put through a splitter of some sort.
Uh-huh. And I'm not sure how that would work. Maybe it's...
I'm thinking thermal. That's the closest I can think of. It's something that is warmer than the surrounding environment would suggest a life form.
Or if you've got extremely sensitive audio technology, I suppose that you could scan for heartbeats or something like that.
Right. You know, now we know that in other science fiction shows and movies, things like Star Trek, they have life form scanning technology that can even identify things like a creature's blood type if they have it
on file. Right, or a brainwave or something like
that.
Yeah,
so, but there's no explanation here. Not that we necessarily expect it. I mean, clearly if this movie were to explain every single piece of science that's on display.
It would be really long and I would watch it forever, actually. That would be, I would love that movie.
It would be called Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 is what it would be called. And there'd probably be fewer hell demons, but maybe more space wolves.
I'm honestly more confused about that visual of the split laser thing on board, because if you're using, if it's just a method to let the operator know where he's pointing the beam or she is pointing the beam, then I guess that counts. But otherwise, if it's a visual light spectrum analysis, it's not going to penetrate anything, and they're clearly trying to sweep rooms with it, which would make it pretty useless.
Which means that you could do something else, like use your eyes.
Right.
You know, those things that each of the characters had. No, well, for a while anyway. Some of the characters don't end up with eyes.
Because...
Spoiler alert.
Where we're going, we don't need eyes to see.
That's exactly what he says. So I have here in my notes, this is it says not so much a note as an observation. This was just one of those things that I picked up on while I was watching the movie. The docking bay that the Event Horizon, that the Lewis and Clark uses to access the Event Horizon is, for reasons that are never explained, Docking Bay 13. It's XIII in Roman numerals, so it's 13.
Mm-hmm.
The Dr. Weir, Sam Neill's character, we didn't name him earlier in the podcast, but Lauren reminded me that the character does, in fact, have a name. It's not just Sam Neill's character. Dr. Weir says that it's the main docking bay. So I don't know why your main docking bay would be 13. I guess this is just one of those little, you know, winks
little
to the audience.
Little nods to the audience. Or you could explain it as being a representation of how much Dr. Weir needs psychiatric help.
Yeah, that we'll get a lot more indication of that in a very short while when they get aboard the Event Horizon. So they do the scan. It does not come back with any anything that would suggest a life form. But then they say, well, we're going to have to do this the old-fashioned way, room by room.
Well, they say that there's these weird, like, kind of amorphous sort of blobs of life forms kind of everywhere,
yeah.
And that they're not seeing any individual human people, which is
right.
What they're looking
right.
for. So they decide to go onto the ship.
Exactly. So a couple of the guys, they create an umbilicus, a pathway that will connect the two ships. This is something else that confused me. All right, so the Lewis and Clark has artificial gravity.
Right.
The Event Horizon normally would have artificial gravity, but at that point...
system is down.
Exactly. They connect an umbilicus between the Lewis and Clark and the Event Horizon. As soon as the characters get into the umbilicus, they're in a zero-G environment. Back aboard the Lewis and Clark, you still have artificial gravity. I'm wondering where you cut that off. Like, how does the artificial gravity know?
Clearly, the artificial gravity, the gravitons get into your air supply. And so if you're not sharing air supplies, then you're not sharing gravitons.
I am almost certain air supply did not supply any of the music in this movie. I'd have to go back and watch it again to see if air supply is in this film, but I don't think it is. All right. So anyway, that was another little goofy bit. So they do a quick tour of the ship. You have some characters going toward the front of the ship, which is where the bridge is and the living quarters, the medical center. All of that is on the front end.
And this is before they get all of the systems back up. So everyone is in, low gravity.
Yeah.
Everything is still extremely cold. They don't have temperature online
right.
yet.
They have magnetic boots, which allow them to stick to the floor.
I appreciated that they at least said, like, hey, we've got magnetic boots. And they even showed a little, like, this is an engaging kind of sequence.
Right.
I thought that was a nice nod to maybe this could be like reality.
Science-ish.
Yes.
I did have a problem in that they talk about how the temperature is below freezing and you see frozen droplets of water floating through the Event Horizon. But there's also this water bottle. I assume it's a water bottle.
It looks very much like a water bottle, and it is clearly full of liquid.
And
that
you
is in liquid form.
Yeah, you hear the sloshing
around.
Noises. So how did that not freeze? Unless, of course, it's not water in that water bottle. It could be another liquid that has a lower freezing point.
I can only assume that it is the viscera of hell.
Yeah, I was thinking vodka. But anyway, all right, so...
honestly, I'm pretty sure that vodka is the viscera of hell.
That's probably fairly accurate.
With both of our...
Okay. Yeah. We're both right. I'm cool with that. So some of the people go toward the forward part of the ship, the forward part of the ship where the bridge and living quarters and everything, all of that is separated by an incredibly long hallway.
From the gravity drive at
right,
the end.
Engineering.
The engineering
whole section. Yeah.
Section
but
at the end.
Specifically, the gravity drive's really the only thing we ever see on that other side of the ship, right? Even though it's the largest part of the ship, we really just see the gravity drive and then the labyrinthian hallways that surround the gravity drive for no apparent reason.
Because Weir needs help.
Yeah. This long neck I thought was pretty odd. When I first saw the design of the ship, I was like, why would you want a neck that long? And the only thing that I could come up with is if within the world they talk about the gravity fluctuations, maybe those fluctuations could adversely affect the crew. And by creating this distance, by creating this long neck-like corridor, you minimize that. Maybe that's the reason. So I can justify it.
I'm willing to give them that
yeah.
one. Yeah.
So, but otherwise you just think, like, why is the ship?
It's basically a plot device.
Yeah.
Because
it looks cool.
Uh-huh, and it looks cool.
Yeah.
And you get that good dramatic tension of needing to have people run up and down it during important
or
moments.
Or fly up and down it when the gravity's not,
yeah.
you know, but or float, I guess, would be the more accurate.
Right. Speaking of, so they do turn on the ship's interior gravity, so no one has to have expensive effects anymore for a while.
For a while, yeah, not till we get to the end. And so we see lots of water splashing down onto the floor and things like that. It was neat little effect.
We'll have a little bit more to say about the tech in Event Horizon after this short break.
Working remotely, Where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. I've last hour on the business. I understand now. A wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you notice the ship's log?
That it's on an optical disc, like a DVD or a CD.
Yeah. So this was made in 1997, so we have to give it that allowance. But it was so funny to me that there's a disc and it's caught inside the computer system.
Right, yeah. My specific note, I think, was like, oh, yes, optical disc.
Yeah, that's right. You know, why go back? You know, we're just lucky it's not an 8-track. So the ship's log is stored on an optical disc, which we thought was adorable.
And this is about when the crew discovers this gravity drive that Dr. Weir has created, and it looks like something out of Hellraiser.
Yeah, I said it looks like the same designer who made the Lament configuration, which is the puzzle box in Hellraiser.
Right.
Would, in this case, it's Dr. Weir must have seen that, because that's what the interior of his gravity drive room looks like.
I am so worried for him. I honestly, I don't think that he was doing well when he was creating this. The entire aesthetic design of this ship is very much in contrast to the design of the Lewis and Clark, which is kind of rough and tumble and has been lived in and utilitarian.
Yeah.
And the interior of this ship reminds me of nothing more than like a 19th century insane asylum.
Yeah.
You've got these very brick-like metal panels in various places, and
right.
You've got all of this weird Victorian-style detailing.
And crazy machinery. So it's kind of a combination of that asylum and, like, imagine that you've been shrunk down and then thrown into the Home Depot power tool section. So you got these enormous, like, drill-like things that are turning around you for no apparent reason.
There's a corridor in the end of the film that is shaped like a coffin, and I'm just like,
yep.
You guys, seriously, you guys, this is amazing. No one said, like, hey, Dr. Weir, do you want to take a vacation and go to Disney World?
I will also say, this is going back to the inspiration for the film, I have read, I assume this is true, it seems like it's true, that the idea was, what if we had The Shining, but set it in space?
Right.
In which case, if you're talking about the film version of The Shining, then,
oh, sure,
you know, Jack Nicholson's character is already pretty freaking crazy before he shows up at the Overlook Hotel.
Oh, totally.
So and Dr. Weir kind of follows that model.
Yeah, yeah. And I did want to say that it's actually clever that that drive itself is built like a giant gyroscope,
yes.
Like a giant hellish gyroscope,
yes.
Because real spaceships do in fact use gyroscopes in their inertial navigation systems, albeit not giant puzzle box looking ones.
Right. Yeah. The one that you're talking about in the movie, it's imagine a globe that's inside of a ring that's inside of another ring. And all of these can rotate independently of each other.
Yeah.
And when it lines up, it flashes light at you and bad things happen. Dr. Weir assures the crew that the gravity drive is not on.
And
the gravity drive is
safe.
Totally on, and it's totally not safe. Yeah. But that's because the ship, as it turns out, is alive. I said that another thing that was kind of interesting, I thought it was a little weird, the characters are forced aboard the Event Horizon because the Lewis and Clark is compromised.
Oh, right. There's a hull breach, and their air supply starts going.
Not going to make another joke. Yeah, so everyone aside from a repair crew goes aboard the Event Horizon. The repair crew tries to repair the damage to the Lewis and Clark. So they discover that the oxygen, to be more specific, the carbon dioxide levels are rising.
And are going to hit because the scrubbers are something, I don't know,
yeah,
plot device.
CO2 scrubbers are not functioning properly. And even if they brought the ones aboard from the Lewis and Clark, it would only give them a little extra time. They only have 20 hours of breathable air.
On the Event Horizon.
Which is enormous. It's a huge ship.
It's very large.
I cannot believe that they only had 20 hours of breathable air. That
maybe,
seems really
maybe
weird.
Maybe the gravity drive eats oxygen. maybe the hell demons that are living
they're
in...
Heavy breathers. Yeah, it could be. I mean,
statistically, I think most hell demons are, in
heavy
fact,
breathers.
Heavy breathers.
Yeah. And they've been on that ship for 7 years, so yeah. It's possible.
Yeah.
I also say that the another fun little fact, this is another not so technical thing, but just one of those things that if you've watched a lot of movies, you appreciate. So they have the sick bay, mm-hmm. a medical center, which supposedly has never been used. Well, on a counter in this medical bay, they have an array of medical tools, most of which are made just for films. They're not actual analogs to real medical tools, although a few of them are.
I mean, and a lot of them are coroner's tools more than medical tools, really.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that you're not going to see in actual medical practice outside of the Victorian era. So,
but if you had ever watched a movie like the Tim Burton's Batman or Little Shop of Horrors, you will recognize some of these. They're the same medical devices that have shown up in movie after movie whenever there's some form of medical horror element to the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I appreciated that. I'm like, oh,
especially amongst all of these incredibly or not incredibly high tech looking, but more fancy, shiny, inexplicable bits of medical tech that they've got floating around.
There. Right. Well, moving forward, you know, things go wrong. Demons are unleashed. People are hallucinating. And then that's when we start to see characters try and take action. Dr. Weir wants to go and activate the failsafe circuit.
To turn off the gravity drive.
Right. What's weird is how inconveniently placed the failsafe circuit is.
Furthermore, it is in this tunnel that, as far as I can tell, is composed of circuit board, which I think is probably a categorically bad idea first, it's sharp, like it's delicate. You don't really want to be crawling around
right
on top of it.
It reminded me of those scenes in Star Trek The Next Generation whenever anything was seriously wrong with the Enterprise.
It's in a Jeffries tube,
right.
10 miles away.
Yeah. Like, maybe we should start putting that stuff closer to where we work, guys.
Further furthermore, it's an entire tunnel made of circuit board, and he has to go to this one very specific panel. As far as I can tell, the only panel within this tunnel of circuit board, and pull out another piece of circuit board
right.
and do something to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, the expansion slot for the Event Horizon is in an inconvenient location. Go buy a different ship, guys. So also, I have a little plot note here. The commanding officer of the Lewis and Clark comes to a conclusion.
Right.
She says to the captain that she thinks, based upon practically
I don't know.
Zero evidence whatsoever, that the ship is alive. Now, first of all, she's right. But
this turns out to be the fantastical element of the film, yes.
Yeah,
but how she, I made the same note. I was just like, I'm not sure where she got that
from. Yeah, it was very convenient. Like, the audience is picking up on it, but the character shouldn't necessarily
right.
know.
I did read that nearly half an hour of footage was taken out of the film before it went to theaters.
It's possible.
And that a lot of that was more along the gore end. And I think that the film benefited from not having that in there, because I thought that the subtle flashes of gore were very effective here.
Sure.
But maybe that was part
of
it.
Yeah, maybe that gave her some of the feeling she had.
Or maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. We don't know. The captain describes what fire in zero G is like and gets it almost exactly wrong.
Super wrong.
He says that it's like liquid. Which I interpret.
It's Lawrence Fishburne, so he's very dramatic about it.
Yeah, not like me. I can't manage drama. Drama, but I'm not dramatic. He says it's like liquid. I interpreted that to mean that he thought it was like liquid on a surface that has gravity. Like, it behaves like liquid would on Earth. Even if he meant liquid in zero G, it's not exactly true. If you were to, say, light a match in a zero G environment or a microgravity environment, the flame would form a little globe around the match head, and it would probably burn in a very, very, faint, but very hot, flame. Like, you would usually get a little blue flame around the head of the matchstick, as
Rather
opposed to the elongated yellow.
The blue, red, yellow thing that you get.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So fire does behave in an interesting way in zero G, but not really like a liquid. I have the little bit about Cooper. We got to talk about Cooper.
Yeah. So this is moving as the plot moves forward. Like we said, it becomes a little bit more fantastical, and therefore we don't have quite as many things to complain about,
right.
Or lovingly complain about. But yeah, so during one of these spacewalks, wherein one of the crew members, Cooper, is trying to repair
the hull of the Lewis
and Clark, there's an explosion.
Yep. Massive catastrophic explosion that destroys the Lewis and Clark. And
shuttles this little bit of ship that he was standing on, spinning wildly off into space.
Right. So Cooper is on, he's tethered to this piece of the ship, and the ship is hurtling off into space with Cooper on it. Cooper has no means of getting.
He doesn't have like a jetpack.
Yeah, he's not wearing a jetpack, which is terrible because, I mean, NASA has jetpacks in standard in every spacesuit. And I guess standards just slipped by 2047. Anyway,
shoddy 2047 standards.
Yeah, first thing he does is he detaches himself from the rotating stuff, which is problematic, too, in that if you were on a rotating piece of equipment and then you let go somehow.
Considering that you weigh less than the rotating piece of equipment, you're going to start moving at a slightly different rate of speed than it is.
Your mass is different. You're still conserving the angular momentum.
Right.
So, but your mass is different. So you're going to turn faster. So we can see this on Earth. If you are on, say, ice skates and you start spinning and then you pull your arms in, or you can try this in your office if you like, sit on a chair that can spin around and around, have someone start spinning you, have your arms out, and then start pulling your arms in, you'll start to spin faster.
If you're listening to this in an office right now, I recommend doing this and just to see what reaction your coworkers
and tell everybody when they ask you why you were doing that Josh and Chuck told you to, because we don't want to heat. Anyway, so if you were to actually detach yourself, you would start spinning even faster. This is also a problem I have with the film Gravity, which I don't think is a spoiler because it happens within the trailer. So anyway, he then ends up deciding to use his oxygen supply as a means of propelling himself back to the event horizon. And he vents his oxygen and rockets back to the ship. I have a couple of problems with the way this was depicted.
Just the fact that it would be physically impossible.
The fact that he would have no way of really directing your flight in a meaningful way, and nor would you necessarily be flying without going into an even crazier tailspin. Yeah, it's kind of, it's problematic, but, you know, dramatic. It's fun. So Cooper becomes a super spaceman and flies back to the event horizon. And then I've got, I only have one other real note, and Lauren, I'll ask you what else you have to say about this, but the last bit is the event horizon has a hull breach in the bridge area. And at this point, the possessed Dr. Weir, spoiler alert, is attacking, Lawrence Fishburne. Not the character. It's Lawrence Fishburne. They've gone so meta. No. It's Lawrence Fishburne's captain character. So Dr. Weir possessed is attacking the captain. And the breach, the hull is breached. Dr. Weir gets flung out into space, technically blown out into space, not sucked out because the air pressure.
That's how. Right.
So the captain ends up trying to crawl up or crawl past where the hallway ends at the bridge so they can seal it off and thus repressurize part of the event horizon and not get blown out into space. I'm not sure that you'd be able to do that. Like, I don't, considering how much was flying past him, I don't know that you would have the strength to hold on, but, or that the materials they was holding on to would have
wouldn't
the strength.
Just right. Yeah. That's, I felt very much the same way. I think that if, I think that that would be hard enough in the kind of pressure differentiation that you've got, in an airplane, let alone in the vacuum of space.
Right. So it's, he has Herculean strength and he manages to make
it. He's Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah. He manages to make it into the hallway. Not only does he make it into the hallway, he's also able to rescue a fellow crew member and pull her to safety before closing the doors and sealing it off. I also thought that this would probably make their problem of very little breathable air somewhat exacerbated.
Right. And also I was confused that within this very same movie a little bit earlier on, one of the other crew members, had in a hallucination driven fit locked himself in an airlock and was going to blow himself out into space. And as that cabin depressurized, it gave you a lot of really great practical gore effects of his veins starting to pop and his eyes bleeding and all of these terrible, terrific horror elements. And none of that happens to these main characters.
Well, he's the captain. Man. He's billed higher. With higher billing, you don't get those easily poppable eyeballs.
Oh, I see. That's cool.
It's a benefit of the job.
When you raise in rank, you just get better eyeballs.
Yeah. At any rate, that is kind of silly. Do you have any other notes that you would like to share?
I guess also speaking of that airlock situation, it's one of my favorite goofy movie tropes wherein something terrible is about to happen in an airlock and you have to hack the door. You always have to hack the door.
Yeah.
And the hacking of the airlock door is always accompanied by pulling the panel out and mussing about with wires. And it always takes approximately 4 seconds longer to do than you actually have.
Right.
I just love that one little silly.
Well, it's also fun that he curls up into a ball, flies out of the airlock, is caught by the captain who's in a spacewalk, who jumps back into the airlock and manages to get him back into the ship. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it's a Superman rescue.
It is a Superman rescue. That is, I think later on, there's a certain point at which people outrun some space flames.
Yeah. There's some space flame outrunning. There's an explosion outrunning.
Right.
Yeah. There's also, you know, we didn't really mention it. The pathway to get to the gravity drive, the hallway that goes through to the gravity drive itself,
is lined with explosives just in case.
Yeah. There's explosives to separate the bridge from the gravity drive in case of catastrophic failure.
Everyone who has watched Star Trek knows sometimes it's really important to separate the dish from engineering
exactly.
So that you can use it as a lifeboat.
I don't think you would necessarily need a neck that long to be able to do this, but that's okay. No, the thing I was going to talk about is that really short hallway where you've got the spinning saw blades of death all around you.
Right. Yeah.
What was that for?
Effect.
Yeah.
It was creepy.
I know that Dr. Weir said something in passing as they were walking down the hallway, but it literally made no sense to me.
Yeah, me neither. I didn't catch what he said. I kind of like, I was sort of watching it going like, I'm not going to rewind for that one because that is not going to explain in any satisfying way what this hallway of saw teeth is doing here.
It kind of makes me think of all the parodies of Star Wars and other movies where the characters are standing right at the edge of a really sharp drop in the middle of like the Death Star and like, why don't we put up a railing? You know, it's kind of that same sort of thing. Why did we put all these jagged saw blades around this corridor for no apparent reason?
My favorite part about that corridor, though, is the dramatic tension involved in it, because it is one of the few places on the ship that something bodily horrible does not happen to anybody.
And it's so sharp.
Yeah. It looks like a tumbler specifically for killing people.
Yeah, it looks like welcome to the abattoir corridor. This is where we will grind you into teeny tiny bits, but it never happens.
It is pretty interesting. So overall, I'm going to give this film a gold star for trying.
I enjoyed it for what it was. It's a fun schlocky kind of horror movie. There's some great bad acting in it, mm-hmm. as well as some, you know,
and
decent
some really
acting.
Decent acting, yeah. I think that Sam Neill did a good job as a really overblown dramatic villain.
Yeah.
I hope you guys enjoyed that classic episode. It was so much fun to talk about the technology of a specific film. I should do more of those. Maybe I should do one about the Matrix series, because that would be a lot of fun, I think. But if you guys have any suggestions for future topics, whether it's about a specific film technology or just a tech topic in general, send me a message on Twitter. The handle is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.